quad evolution, by enforcing this mapping of excited coherence and by knowing that electric field is down to zero, that ensures that at the end, whatever happens to our light atom system, it will happen exactly time reversed, so that at the end of the whole process, all atoms are back in the ground state where we started, and the photon is emitted for sure. So this is actually a very nice and very simple way to prove perfect time reversal. This is a very simple way to prove perfect quantum memory. You do not have to solve any Schrödinger equation, do anything complicated. You just have to look at a hidden symmetry which is hidden in the Maxwell Block equation. So this is actually a proof which goes back to Barbara Krauss, which she did at the time when I still was in Nicolas Jusin's lab. And at the same time, similar ideas have been put forward by Matthias Nielsen and Stefan Kröll, and also by Annabel Alexander from the Australian group, Michael, Matthias and Stefan, they are in Lund. This is the group in Canberra, which has done a lot of things there. Just want to point out that there is a different way of doing photon echo quantum memory, that is the atomic frequency comms that Nicola has mentioned this morning. And under certain constellations, you can actually show that both can be described, both approaches to quantum memory can be described using a combined, a joint mathematical framework. So let's extend a little bit on this idea and go beyond simple storage. So I recall that at some point we have these two pi pulses which map coherence between state 1 and 3 onto coherence between state 1 and 2 and back. Yeah? What has been shown in 2004 by Sergei Moiseev is that if we replace this readout pulse, meaning this pi pulse here, by a sequence of pulses, let's say two pulses, one with an area which is smaller than pi, which then recalls coherence only partially, which then gives rise to emission of the photon with a certain probability amplitude, which is not unity, and then recall the rest using a pi pulse, then a photon which comes in one temporal mode would come out of our memory in a superposition, in a coherent superposition of two temporal modes. So what we have here resembles very much a standard beam splitter, only that here our unity on our interaction acts on temporal modes, while a standard beam splitter acts on spatial modes. But the rest is similar. So that gave rise to the idea, okay, how far can we actually go with analogon? Can we use something like that? Can we implement something in the lab? And the important thing you have to realize, and that is a result which is due to Michael Reck and Anton Zeilinger and two others back in 1994, which says that any discrete unitary operator can be realized with beam splitters and phase shifters. Well, here we have our beam splitter and we have our phase shifter. So how far can we use this idea? How far can we spin this idea? And can we actually use it in order to implement, well, maybe not any unitary transformation, but maybe some of them. So, experimentally, photon echo quantum memory is still very challenging. It has been done right now. There's lots of great results. We have 66% storage in a group in Canberra. In Geneva, we have AFC and CRIB and also the mapping on ground state coherence. In Orsay, there have also been experiments which were good, and Lund have also done work there. So there is a lot of things happening right now. And if you combine the different results and gloss over the fact that these are all different crystals, you really get something which is really powerful. Well, we still have to combine all these different things, but I think it's really moving fast in the right direction. But anyway, it is still tricky to do. What is much simpler is to use something which is known since 1982, or maybe even longer, which is the stimulated photon echo. Well, it is very similar, and I will come back to that in the next two slides, and it is much, much simpler to implement in the lab. The problem of this approach is the efficiency is very small if you want to make sure that the fidelity of your recall state with the input state is large, what we need. But still, it can serve as a test bed for photon echo-based storage and manipulation. So this whole idea goes back to 1963 and 1964, where independently Kopp-Willem and Najibarov and Konit, Abella and Hartmann proposed a photon echo type, well, a photon echo. So that was itself, Jill, that itself was initiated by Hans spin echo, which was discovered before. So here as well, we have an inhomogeneously broadened medium. So here we look right now at the Bloch sphere that describes, the state of our ensemble of atoms, and we send in the first pi over 2 pulse. So we assume that all atoms are initially in the ground state. This is an optical transition, so there is no thermally excited population in the excited state here. So the first pi over 2 pulse brings the Bloch vector to the equator, and now we look at everything in the equatorial plane, and we assume that the first pi over 2 pulse made a rotation around the axis V, so right now everything points into the plus U direction. Now, given that all these, well, that our ensemble is inhomogeneously broadened, while atoms with different resonance frequency will pick up phase, the phase that determines the superposition between ground and excited state, pick up this phase at different rates. So what we get is dephasing. Our macroscopic block vector pointing in that direction will dephase. Some atoms move into this direction, some atoms block vector moves clockwise, and some counterclockwise. So we get dephasing. The question is right now, can we undo dephasing? And this dephasing is exactly the same thing which happens in the standard quantum memory type approach. In this approach here, dephasing is undone not by reversing the inhomogeneous broadening, because that requires more control on the atom than at that time people knew was possible. But you can do it by sending in a pi pulse, which also makes a rotation around V. And after that, we flip all these individual block vectors around this axis here, so they start, they just lie on the opposite side of the sphere. And, well, the phase evolution is still the same, so right now, instead of dephasing, we get rephasing. And you see that then the same time later, or the same time as the time here, this time later, all individual dipole moments will superpose coherently and give rise to the emission of a pulse of light, which is called an echo pulse. Yeah? So this is the standard photon echo, and that one is known for quite a long time. And then in 1979 and 82, again, independently, Russian researchers, Eluten, Zakharov, and Mendekind, probably pronounced it wrongly, and also Thomas Mossberg from the United States, proposed how you can actually extend that idea to storage of data. Yeah. So here, this is the original scheme, a pi over 2 pulse, a pi pulse, and the echo comes out. Now let's split the pi pulse into two pi over 2 pulses, and let's even separate them in time. So it turns out that even then, while we still get an echo out. And now you can think of that like, well, the full transformation of this double pulse, if I assume for simplicity right now, two delta pulses, is a sinus where the spacing between two maxima is 2 pi over the duration between these two pulses. Yeah? So what it actually means is that the atoms are irradiated by light with this spectrum, which then gives rise to atoms, depending on their frequency, which are in the ground state, if there was no light at the frequency, or are excited with a certain probability if they would absorb that frequency component here. So what we actually do here is to register the Fourier transformation of this data pulse sequence as an absorption grating in the atoms. And then after that, we send another pulse of light in. This light will see a medium whose absorption is frequency dependent, will thereby take on a similar Fourier spectrum here, and that means that whatever comes out cannot be one single pulse, but must be two pulses, and the second one is the echo. Is the echo here. Now, you can extend that, and you see very, very easily what happens. Well, if I don't use one single pulse here, but a sequence of pulses, well, the Fourier transformation of these three certainly reflects, well, these three. And now, if I send in this data pulse, well, this read pulse here, well, what comes out are the remaining pulses. Yeah? So you see directly how we come to a storage of classical pulses in this type of setup. And here are just some results. I think the record is storage of 1760 bits in one single spatial location by having one write pulse, this whole sequence of read pulses, data pulses, and then one read pulse who reads all that out. What you see here is an experiment that was done in Stefan Kroll's group where they actually stored 330 bits. And what you see here is the recall bit, and you see very well that 0 and 1s are easily distinguishable. So that's, of course, interesting, but we want to go beyond. And one of the features in quantum information or quantum physics in general is, of course, the fact that we can have superpositions, that we can have interference. And many of the Euler transformations that I talked about in my first slide are actually done using optical interferometers. Yeah? And we have heard this morning from Nicolas a first approach to that. So that was sending in a pulse of light through an interferometer, which then creates two pulses. And what I have here right now is the optical analogon to what I'm going to talk about later, because you're much more used, or many people, including myself, are much more used to that one. I always find it much simpler to drive or to use this analogon here. So we create from one pulse of light, we create two, and we think of that as this one having been constituted of many individual photons, each one in the superposition of being here or here. It could be timing qubit. And then to analyze it, we send this again through an interferometer with the same path length difference, so either our photon goes straight through, or it's delayed, and if both are opened, it goes both straight through and it's delayed, and what we get then is interference and superposition in the central time window here, and then depending on the phase in this measurement interferometer in the phase of whatever was encoded initially, well, we get constructive or destructive interference. So what we have here is actually a von Neumann measurement, a projection measurement on the two-dimensional Hilbert space, or in this temporal window, in the two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is originally used in order to encode this qubit here. So how do we do this with photon echoes? Well, we send in a right pulse and two data pulses. So that would mimic what was created here by this interferometer. Then if we read it out once, well, we get this echo, which resembles the data pulse, only much weaker. If we read it out instead of the first readout a little bit earlier or later, well, we get the same thing, only everything is displaced in time. Now, if the readout pulses are sufficiently weak, so that a lot of this population grating, what I have initially created by having this interaction between these three pulses and my atomic medium, that a lot of this grating is still persistent, well, I get two echoes out, and again, I get superposition and interference of echoes in the middle time window. And then again, if I change the phase between read pulses or data pulses, well, I see the sinusoidal variation, or you can see perfect constructive interference here, or close to perfect destructive interference here. And if we do this by changing the phase in small steps, well, we see the sinusoidal changes of count rates or intensities observed as one expects from a standard optical experiment. And then if I change the phase in the data pulse, well, we see that everything is displaced as expected, as it would be in a standard optical setup. So that was done back in 2006. Again, Nicolas' group, when I was still there. And we want to go a little beyond that right now. And we want to show something which is a little bit more complicated and want to see a little bit, okay, how far can we go? What are really advantages and drawbacks with this method? And what we saw already before is that the stability and the quality of these measurements was really, really good. The visibility is very, very close to one, which in an optical setup is very difficult to achieve. So that gives promise, that gives hope for doing something more complicated. And the more complicated thing that we want to do is to go beyond von Neumann measurements. Yeah? So you know, well, von Neumann measurements allow you to make projections onto orthogonal subspaces, horizontal, vertical, a photon arriving here or here. But it is possible in principle to do also projection measurements on non-orthogonal states, obviously not always successful. So if you do that, there must be also the possibility that sometimes you cannot identify your quantum state, and that is built in quantum mechanics, and these things actually give rise to the security of quantum cryptography, and obviously for the fundamental understanding of quantum information science, it's a very important thing to see, okay, how good can you actually identify states? Can you always, well, it turns out there's two possibilities. Either you always have a result, but sometimes it's wrong, or you do not always have a result, but if you get one, you know exactly what quantum state was there. So these things have been investigated starting in 1987 and 8 by Ivanovich, Deeks, and Paris. Then there was more work by Stephen Bartlett, who is somewhere here, I think, and others. So there's been quite a lot of theoretical work. There have also been a couple of experiments, and we want to follow this path. So for timing qubits, the setup to identify two different qubit states, which are written here with computational states 0 and 1, so that would be photon in an early time interval or in a late time interval, well, you see that these two states are clearly non-orthogonal. The inner product is not 0. Yeah? Let's assume right now that the task is to identify one or the other, and the two are given to us randomly distributed with the same probability. So the first thing we do is that we send this state, which is depicted here, onto a very fast switch, which is synchronized with the arrival time of these different wave packets, such that the early arriving wave packet will be sent to the delay arm here, and the later arriving wave packet will be sent to the shorter arm here. So what we get is a mapping of that state to this state here. So what we have done is actually we have simply exchanged 0 and 1, which label time bin qubit basis states, with A and B, which right now label spatial modes. The next thing we do is that we act with loss on whatever is in mode B, or rather we couple mode B partially into mode C. That is done here right now. And you see, if you choose the loss or the coupling ratio correctly, that is the state which emerges. Now let's imagine we do not find a photon in mode C prime here, which then means that we have to look at the subspace which is described by modes A and B. So if I look at the subspace, I see that whatever remains from this, so 1 over square root of 3, A plus or minus B, these two states become orthogonal. So right now I can make a standard von Neumann projection measurement and can conclusively identify is it one state or the other one? Yeah? To summarize that, what we can do with this setup is send in this quantum state. We have to know what are the two states we have to identify. If we get a detection in mode C prime, well, we know that we cannot identify the state, so we don't know anything. If we get a detection in mode A, well, this corresponds unambiguously, or we know unambiguously that the input state was the state psi plus. And if we get a detection in mode B prime, we know unambiguously that the input state was psi minus. So this is how you would do it with an optical setup. And of course, as I said, you cannot always identify or always distinguish between the states, but the fraction is given by 1 minus the overlap between the two states here, and this is what is now called the Ivanovich-Deeks Paris limit. In real, we would not use this optical switch because optical switches are difficult to synchronize and are lossy, so we can achieve the same thing by just having a standard beam splitter, and then instead of sending the early pulse to the delay line and the late pulse here, while both wave packets evolve through both arms, so what we get at the output is not just one possible detection time, but three of them. But if you look at the central time temporal window, then we get exactly what I have explained to you before using the other slide. So what we still need right now is to identify how, given the matrix that you want to do, that you want to implement, how do we implement with photon echoes? How do we do this step? In those examples before, it was rather simple, but if you get something more complicated, you need something which is a little bit more structured, something that really gives you a recipe to this. And the first thing we realize is that if we work with sufficiently weak pulses, and for simplicity right now we assume that all these pulses are short, are delta pulses, that then the electric field in the echo, which would correspond to the probability amplitude of a particular quantum state, remember an echo arising at time t would correspond to one of my basis vectors for my qubit, or qutrit, this one is linear in the electric field of the data pulse and in the electric field of the weak pulse. Why is that important? Well, if we look at the state that we would get after some matrix acts on our input state alpha beta, so alpha would be the probability amplitude associated with a particular particular data pulse arising at a particular time, beta is the probability amplitude associated with a data pulse at a different time. So if we have some matrix acting on that, this gives this new vector here. So that tells us that we have to read out the data pulse which encodes probability amplitude alpha with a photon echo whose electric field is given by this complex number here, so we have some magnitude and we have some phase, and we have to superpose that date, this photon echo, with a photon echo that arises from the data pulse beta and which is read out with a read pulse which has this electric field magnitude. So that would be the first new basis vector, that would be a photon echo arriving at a particular time. Now, the second basis vector would be given by this one, and then if you have a more complicated transformation, we just go along with it. Yeah? So the important thing is that the echo here is linear in data and read pulse electric fields, and that obviously this multiplication here, these are all linear things. So if you do that, what you get instead of this optical setup, you get a series of readout pulses. So there are two readout pulses which then correspond, if you look at the central mode here, which correspond to the output number 1, then you repeat your sequence of readout pulses just with a different phase. Here's a phase change of pi, here's no phase change between these two, and that corresponds then to the second output, and then at the end, well, you read out once more, and then whatever you find in this time window here, and the laser pointer is not working very well, I hope you can still see it, this corresponds then to the projection or to the detection in the third output here. So that's really a one-to-one mapping between a photon echo and an optical setup. So the experimental setup, well, we work with erbium lithium niobate, and in addition to having erbium in the lithium niobate, we also have a waveguide in the lithium niobate. So that makes coupling with fibers relatively easy and is promising for future implementation in networks, and also has advantages if you have to apply electric fields, which is not done in this setup right now. So the data pulses that we create start with a CW laser at 1532 nanometer wavelength. So this is actually the transition between the 4i15½ and 4i13½ multiplex, and what we use is the lowest line Stark levels in those, so then we have a zero phonon line. So we work at that wavelength here. Then we intensity and phase modulate the CW laser so that at the end we get pulses out. We amplify everything, in an erbium-doped fiber amplifier, so that is the nice thing about working at telecom wavelengths, you have all these things handy. There's another intensity modulator here which simply makes sure that the amplified spontaneous emission that is always exiting the fiber amplifier does not heat up the waveguide, doesn't heat up the cryostat, or burn spectral holes in this material here. And then we have a sequence of pulses which enter the waveguide. The pulse length, 15 nanoseconds. The peak intensities or peak powers are 5 milliwatt for the read pulse and 1 milliwatt for the data, sorry, for the write pulse and 1 milliwatt for the data and read pulses. So the coherence time we get at 3 Kelvin and 0.4 Tesla is roughly 80 microseconds, which is by far long enough for anything you want to do. And at the end, we look at the signal with a fast photodiode and look at the oscilloscope. Yeah. That is the setup. What you see here is this erbium-doped designated waveguide under red light illumination. So you see here the waveguide shining. So the whole thing is then in the cryostat. We couple fibers from here and from here against the waveguide and apply a magnetic field in the direction in order to increase the coherence time. So here what you see here and here is the superconducting coil we use for that. Here are the experimental results. So this is just a reminder of the sequence that we need. So we send in a first write pulse, two data pulses, and then we have these three sequences of recall pulses. And what you see here is the recall pulses measured before the cryostat, before the sample. And what you see in red is what we get out after the cryostat. So that includes the response of the sample. And what you see is the sequence of pulses here, here, and here. So what that actually is exactly what we expect from the optical setup. And the only thing which is different is this decrease here, which is the detector response. So this is not due to light. This is directly what happens with the detector. And you see, for instance, if we send in the Psi plus state, that then we have a very large probability of detecting something in this central time window here. Basically, no probability of detecting anything in this middle time window here. And then there is some probability of detecting something in what is the inconclusive event. So that clearly shows us that we can identify the plus state. We find a detection here, but none here. If we send in the minus state, well, we find basically nothing in this time window, a lot in this time window here, and we still have the inconclusive results. Now, we repeated this measurement for many different input states, all of the form cosinus alpha 0 plus or minus sinus alpha and 1. It's not the most general one. We didn't change the phase between these two, but it already covers a large set of possible states. And what we have plotted here, the black dots here, is the error rate when doing an unambiguous state discrimination, when doing a generalized measurement. So you see it's always around, let's say, 2% or so. Theoretically, it should be zero. Well, that's real life, so it's a little bit larger. So that is what you would expect, or what you do expect, from this unambiguous state discrimination. If you do the standard von Neumann measurement, where you always get a result, but sometimes it's wrong, well, then the error rate is given by these red dots here. So we see that for, well, sending in the state where actually the two states identify are orthogonal, these error rates are very closely the same, which should be the case. And then as soon as you move away from having two orthogonal states, the error rate in the von Neumann measurement increases and is always larger than the error rate in an ambiguous state discrimination measurement. Okay, so let me discuss this and give you a short outlook for the future. So what I've shown you is storage and data manipulation using a photon echo type atom light interaction. In this case, it was a classical traditional photon echo which does not allow us to store single photons, but I've shown you here, you can learn a lot from that and you can really learn a lot of things that you can actually do. We believe that there is a way to generalize that also to quantum state, to true quantum state storage protocols, and that then opens quite a lot of possibilities in quantum information processing. The examples I've given was unambiguous state discrimination for qubits, and it turns out that you can easily also do it with qutrits. And I don't want to go into any detail here. What I show here is an optical setup which was realized in the group of Ephraim Steinberg. So what you see here is 8 interleaved interferometers which have to be phase stabilized. So that becomes very easily a very complicated and difficult to control setup, and that's not even a complicated measurement. For photon echo approach, it simply means that the readout sequence has two times three pulses instead of two times two, and one times two instead of one times one. So it's very easy to go from one setup to the other one. Changing your interferometer, rebuilding your interferometer means you have to reprogram your function generator, which may take a minute or maybe 10, but it's a very, very simple thing. So that is kind of what you see here, and I don't go into detail on the right-hand side, is the outcome of that measurement. But what I want to show you here is that it's indeed very simple to go from one setup to the other one, and I think you can do very complicated setups. So the open questions that remain right now, well, can we use these kind of approaches for multipath interferometric precision measurements. Monitor very rapidly changing index of refraction changes in an explosion, for instance. Yeah? It could be possible. How good it gets, I don't know. I haven't looked into it in detail, but it's promising, and that may actually already work using the traditional, not efficient approach, the one that we have pursued here. The other one is, well, there's a lot of implementations of joint measurements that you can do using linear optics. Actually, you can do all of them. It's not as efficient as in if you use true CNOT gates, for instance, but you can do a lot. And there's Neil Laflamme in Melbourne has shown us how to do it. And the question which is open right now is, okay, can you build your linear quantum computer or some information processor, quantum information processor, using that kind of approach with this huge possibility where you can easily change the setup and program a different type of unitary operation, and where the stability is given by the stability of your function generator, which is much easier to control than the stability of your interferometer? I think it's a very interesting thought. I don't know the answer, but it's for sure worth pursuing further. So I thank you for your attention. I thank the sponsors and the three people who were involved in this. It's Cecilia Lamela, Artie Delfan, and Erhang Samdeniwak.
How did you define the error rate from the practical data?
From the practical data, what we do is we look at the area of the pulses, which would then correspond to the probability of detecting something, and we subtract the background, which we take by taking a straight line here.
So you use the deterministic right hook or non-deterministic right hook?
Well, this is just a laser which is modulated. So we know when the pulses come, but it's not single photons. It's classical. Well, it's many single photons at the same time. You can think of it like that, but they are prepared in the same state you would prepare it if it were a single photon. Only instead of repeating the measurement 100,000 times, we do it once and process them all at the same time. It's possible in this. Of course, you cannot do any nonlinear things or CNOT gates with that approach.
No more
of Waterloo and the Institute for Quantum Computing. And the title of this talk is Quantum Communication and Information Processing with Photon Experiments.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. It is a great pleasure for me to be able to present our work to you today. And I would like to point out as a first aspect that this is seems a bit complicated, but it kind of reflects my chaotic status in the past years. So finally, I'm locating at the Institute for Quantum Computing in Waterloo, but also up to recently, I was at the EKOKI in Vienna, at the Institute for Quantum Optics, but also I spent a good time in the last 2 years in Brisbane and Andrew White's lab. So and the work I'm presenting today is like a mixture of all those institutions. So Of course, we've heard a lot about photons and quantum information processing with photons. I'd just like to remind ourselves again, why do we do information, quantum information with photons? There are a couple of good advantages. They are easy to handle, they're easy to transmit, manipulate. They are really fast, so the very short coherence times, but long lifetimes, and all those things make them really convenient and easy to handle quantum systems. However, there are some harder parts, and actually we've already heard about quite a lot about that in the conference. So storage, keeping photons localized is hard, but there is a lot of efforts on quantum memories. And the other thing is getting single photons to interact with each other is also hard, so that makes it difficult to then use them directly in quantum computing. But I'll say a little bit show a little bit about those schemes. So one of the main protocols, of course, for an application of quantum information is quantum key distribution, where two parties, Alice and Bob, want to share secrets and or secure communication. And so essentially they establish a quantum key by sending photons across. Well, that's one of the best possibilities. And it can be either that they transmit single photons or entangled photons, with entangled photons exploiting the quantum correlations and the quantum non-locality, and hence use the, well, in both cases, by observing their correlation measurements, essentially they can detect if somebody has in between attempted to manipulate the photons, detect them, or do whatever attacks. So I don't think at this audience we need to say much more. So one thing which has always been a very big interest also from my side was, how can we extend distances? There's already been a lot of discussion, and also like Nicola mentioned again in the morning, today's experiment in optical fibers, for instance, they can reach around the order of 200 kilometers. That's the kind of level we have. And if we restrict ourselves to a single transmission on ground, we might be finally reaching maybe 500 kilometers or something, but then we will face like a stop. It will get harder to go beyond on that. But of course, with quantum cryptography, we don't want to get stuck in the situation of the cans and the wire telephone, because it's a nice feature, but not too practical in the end. We want to go beyond. And clearly, quantum repeaters are one good solution in that direction. And also Wolfgang just showed us some very good advances in these directions. That is one approach. But there is another possible approach, that is to go to satellites and exploit the fact that if a satellite is placed in space, there'll be essentially empty space for the photons to transmit in that medium, or actually there is no medium, so we can have long distances. We can cover essentially global quantum cryptography networks by for instance making the satellite a trusted node. So that is a very interesting and fascinating direction. And for instance, in Europe, we have been putting forward the so-called Space Quest program, which mainly aimed at as a first demonstrator of doing quantum communication in space, to put an entangled photon source onto the International Space Station, and for instance, send one of the entangled photons down, or both entangled photons, and do both quantum cryptography, proof of concept experiments, as well as testing entanglement over large distances. The current status of this project is that currently there is an activity to develop entangled photon source and a faint laser source, which is suitable for the space environment. This is in the ArtEST-5 framework. So it's all about making such an entangled photon source, which can, for instance, sustain the vibration. It can sustain the the environment, like the thermal and radiation and vacuum environment. So that's looking very promising and moving ahead. So ESA has already identified quantum physics experiments, quantum optics, but more in a general term for their future science programs. And for instance, such tests of testing entanglement in space is already on the long term, they call it the cosmic vision of the European Space Agency. This is a design, the current design model of such a unit. It's about 90 centimeters across and contains all the modules which would be necessary, like the quantum sources, but also other classical modules, data processing or lasers, thermal management. And then finally, there would be two telescopes, essentially periscopes, which can point in 2 pi of space, and then we can reach any part on ground. So on the, what would a ground station look like? As an example, this is the optical ground station of ESA, which is conveniently located on Tenerife. So it's also quite a pleasant place to work. And we have been able to access this station and do a range of proof of concept experiments by using the 1 meter diameter telescope in that facility, which is essentially built for laser communication. That is also very convenient because below the telescope there is the focal room, so to say, where essentially it's an optical bench, an optical lab, which can be easily accessed, and there we can place our polarization analyzers and detector modules. So across from Tenerife, there's the other island, La Palma. It's about 144 kilometers in distance, and we placed a transmitter there, which is a self-built small telescope assembly, just essentially a lens of that diameter. And we were able to show a range of proof of principle experiments. Most notably, we did entanglement-based QKD along that distance. But very recently, we were able to complete experiments, which I see as the most important proof of concept of doing the entangled source on the space station. What we did was essentially create an entangled photon pair on the source side and send both photons across the 144 kilometers. And essentially, we do detect them in the same receiver, but there is a time delay, and also there is a spatial separation at the beginning. So the photons, for most of the part, they see separate paths and or individual paths. And so this situation corresponds to having a symmetric situation with 2 times 144 kilometers and the source in the middle. And that's in terms of losses and that kind of situation, it is very similar to what we would expect from the going down from the space station, like depicted here, to two separate receivers. And we were able to, for instance, show that the quantum correlation is still present after that long transfer. So in terms of, there's another interesting feature, in terms of lifetime, the travel time of that distance is half a millisecond, and so essentially the entangled photons were both after creation, so from the point of creation to the point of detection, both that lasted a half a millisecond. So that's I think the longest reported lifetime of entangled photons for both photons. So in the future, there is a lot of stuff ongoing. We have to work on forming teams of scientists and industry, further development of hardware, developing mission concepts. We have to look at if we want to, for instance, use it for quantum cryptography networks, one could embed it in those secure, trusted node networks like the SACO QC, which was mentioned. And also one can consider what would a smaller mission look like, maybe a piggyback solution as a proof of principle. So now I would like to switch to a different topic, which is also very interesting, and which is about doing quantum computing with photons. As I tried to mention in the beginning, photons are easy to handle, and for instance, the single qubit operations, there, like straightforward, and can done with high quality. But getting 2-qubit gates with photons, that's the hard task. And for instance, what one would effectively need are strong pair nonlinearities. So there, I mean, it's easy to draw such a circuit. That there is like 2 interferometers, and in between we would need this kind of pair nonlinearity, which can do a 2-photon dependent phase. But this is very hard to achieve directly in a lab. So the question is, yeah, is photonic QAP a lost case? Not necessarily yet. There is the, like, what I like to call the first salvage of LOQC. The first salvage is LOQC, linear optics quantum computing. So interestingly, it was discovered that one can build linear optic circuits, so essentially based on interferometers and using ancillary photons coming in and then detect them again in order to effectively realize those nonlinearities, those that Kerr nonlinearity which we need. And however, so that's the famous paper by Neil Laflamme and Milburn. However, it is very consuming on resources, on efficiencies, and so on. But it was fascinating to see that it is possible at all. Solvable.
Scalable.
Or scalable, maybe. Scalable, yeah.
Okay.
Scalable. Actually, that was like typing it and not looking anymore. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's interesting. So you actually read what is up there. So what I must point out at this point is that didn't want to go into the details. There have been a range of proof of concept experiments of those basic circuits, the nonlinear sign shift itself, or even the linear optic control set or C0 gate. There have been a lot of those experiments. One which I would like to point out, which was quite recent, actually done mainly in Andrew White's lab in Brisbane, that it was, for instance, discovered that one can make such circuits, like improve them by making shortcuts through higher dimensions. It's very interesting. For instance, if one needs to do a 3-qubit operation, if one breaks it down into 2-qubit gates and single-qubit operations, it would look like that, and effectively one would need 6 2-qubit operations. But for instance, by cleverly encoding the third one into a 3-dimensional space and taking one of those dimensions like around the whole circuit and combining it afterwards, this can do exactly the same as the above circuit, and essentially one only needs 3 2-qubit operations. And it turned out that, which was cleverly discovered by a couple of theorists, that this can be realized in a rather simple optical circuit based on these displacing polarizers and with the ancillary photons coming in. So essentially, those two partial polarizing beam filters realized the first two linear optical C0s, and the last one is done by post selection essentially. So that's also a very interesting line of thought. But still, in linear optics, one can do maybe better, and that is to go to the one-way computing concept, to do cluster states where the difficulty of doing those 2-photon, 2-qubit operations is then transferred into doing a sequence of measurements, single photon measurements onto the particles prepared in a very particular entangled state, which is a cluster state. Also there, with photons, there has been a range of experiments in particular with 4-photon cube cluster states. And what has also recently, well, not so recent anymore, but done not so long ago in Vienna, was to actually do the deterministic version of the cluster computing, where the active feed forward is included, which is also needed. And here the measurements of the photons 1 and 2, for instance, are fed forward onto the still remaining photon 3 and also photon 4. And these measurements are adapted depending on what output is detected here. And then one can effectively do a deterministic one qubit operation, like preparing this final photon in a certain particular qubit state. But notably, the kind of speed for this operation from the detection to the feed forward is about 150 nanoseconds. So that's actually quite a fast quantum computer in some sense. And the main limitation is actually the electronics. So it's not the photons. So it's the detection and the feed forward electronics, the Pockel cells, which takes up all the time. So there is actually a huge potential there for speeding up these kind of circuits. So what I would like to go towards now is like the consideration of, okay, we can do those experiments, those proof of principle experiments, but in terms of experimental performance or reaching the final goal of doing a real scalable quantum computer, we are still a far way. There's still a long way to go. For instance, if you take just a simple four photon circuit, we are usually having a pump rate of creating those entangled photons at 80 megahertz, and finally we're observing photons maybe at the level of 1 hertz, 10 hertz. So, of course, there is a huge difference there, and we are losing a lot of signals on the way. So, what does it mean? How can we get closer towards that kind of goal? And of course, what we have to do is, let's take a look at the main key experimental devices which are needed, the requisites. So we need to have sources, detectors, and circuits, so on. And okay, how good do those components, for instance, have to be in order to reach at least the next step of quantum computing, like doing heralded gates or creating heralded states, like a heralded entangled pair, meaning without post selection. And how good do we have to be? So the approach we took was to go to a simulation, so representing every photon mode as a photon number in a Fock space. So it's a highly dimensional problem, and running through those kind of circuits. Like this is the simplified KLM gate, which works in such a way. We have a control and a target photon coming in, and then we have those ancillary detections. So two zeros have to be detected here, and there are two ancillary photons coming in, and there has to be a 1-1 detection here. And this gate will work if there is one photon here and another here, and only one each. Then the output would be successful, and we would get this gate operation. So we would have the CNOT, for instance. So that's what we call a heralded gate. But okay, how good does if we want to realize such a circuit in the lab, how good do our sources need to be? We need four sources here and our detectors. So that, for instance, if we create an entangled pair, that it, for instance, would be able to violate a Bell inequality. Or one can also look at other scalable gates, as a Franzen gate or the Knill gate. Another thing to look at was, which we considered, okay, go one step beyond. We have two Bell pairs, and we want to create a GHZ pair by a fusion, for instance, putting a fusion in between. How good do the circuits have to be, the components, in order to get a GHZ state which is useful or even detectable? And now comes the hard part of the result, and it's looking very challenging. So this chart here shows that if we take a single photon source, what is the kind of success probability that the source must have versus what is the single photon-ness of that source. So characterized as the second order function, the G2 at zero. And it turns out, in order to get a successful event from those scalable gates which I just showed, we would have to sit down here. We would need a single photon source which has a success probability in the range of 90%, and a G2 which is below or at the range of 0.1. And that's very challenging. And actually, and all of those simulations were run, for instance, at detection efficiencies of 90%. So it really is hard. But we have also looking at the non-scalable schemes, like doing partially polarized beam splitter as a C-naught, which works in post-selection. But there we're not so affected by the efficiencies because we just select those events where you have a click here and a click there, and so we are much more reluctant. We can have the success probability go right down and it will still work, even though it's not really useful in the end. But this is interesting because then we can make a summary and get together like a chart, bring together for various quantum optics experiments and quantum optics circuits, how good do our sources need to be in terms of success probability and this single photon net. So these are the non-scalable, and over here we have these scalable gates. And for instance, this curve here would be if we create one photon with by heralding a photon from down conversion, one SPDC. And you can see as we turn up the power of the down converter, clearly we're running away. We can improve the success probability, but also the single photon net suffers. So heralding single photons with down conversion is a good first step, but we can never reach this kind of area. But there is a solution, and that is to use down conversion in parallel, to use like a cascaded version, or have several down converters next to each other and switch them together depending on which of them fired. And so one can essentially make a network of these several switched SPDCs and for instance sit at one point, and as we increase the number 2, 4, 8 and so on, we can just keep the single photon quality and move closer towards this this desired region. And also we can look at, okay, what about other sources? So there is quantum dots and V sensors and so on. And after discussing with some of the experts in this area, so what they think is, for instance, for NV centers and quantum dots alike, so the G2 is around at the moment 0.1. That's what sort of is achieved in the lab. And the success probability can be like in this area, maybe up to 50%. Or if we use atoms or ions in cavity QED to create single photons, there has been a range of demonstrations and experiments. The G2 can be, for instance, very good, but also the single photon quality, the success probability is also hard to bring up. It's mainly limited by to get the high coupling of the photons. And that's why actually looking at the scheme of switching several down conversions in parallel and making one improved heralded state is a feasible way to go. Useful way. And it's just a very recent result and this was actually done in Vienna. We managed to demonstrate at least a 4-to-1 switching of such a single photon. So by combining essentially two entangled photon pairs, which corresponds to, since we have the two polarization, it corresponds to having four pairs. And depending where the trigger photon clicks, so we have four trigger detectors, we can run the photons through a fast router and get out a improved single photon. And we managed to show how for one, two, or four such down converters, we can improve the success probability by keeping this G2 number constant. So with this, I would like to summarize. I hope I managed to convince you that why we want to do photonic quantum computing and quantum communication. Of course, long distance are the goal or one of the goals, and there is a lot of interesting work happening in that direction. And the other direction is, of course, doing linear optics quantum computing with photons is still is also a very interesting direction to take, and there is still a high potential for optimization, for instance, and there's still a lot to come. And finally, I'd like to point out the various teams, which also, as I said in the beginning, I was sort of delocalized. And now at IQC, we're establishing the lab, we call it the Quantum Photonics Laboratory, and already we have kind of three members already, and more to come. But also in IQC, I'm directly collaborating with the group of Gregor Weiss. Gregor is actually in Innsbruck now, but the members are still present and in the lab. But also, of course, a lot of this work was done in Vienna in the group of Anton Zeilinger, but also in Brisbane with Andrew White. And finally, I would like to point out that since it's a new lab, there are certainly good opportunities, students and postdocs, so maybe you could convey that to your lab and people. Thank you very much. It really depends what the task is, I think. If it's fiber-based, then probably 1500 is the best choice. And if it's free space, it depends. It's a trade-off between atmospheric transmission, detection, and many things. So in free space, shorter wavelengths are actually better.
Okay.
So at the moment, the SpaceQuest is set up for 800 nanometers, but actually it might be worth thinking of going to even shorter, like green 500. That was at the range of 800, around 800 nanometers.
Okay.
So what's the loss that you would have for a satellite
to ground station? That's of course it depends on so many factors, but if you take the International Space Station to ground, and you have a transmitter of maybe 10 centimeters. And a receiver of 1 meter, that corresponds so to about 15 dB. 15. So, but of course, for instance, as a satellite moves along, your first, you're very shallow, you know, shallow angle, so it will certainly be more, and longer distance. As you get closer, it will be less. So in that kind of region. But it turns out that going down is much better than going up, because it's much better if the atmospheric distortion is at the end of the link, and not at the beginning. Okay.
Any other questions? No. Let's thank the speaker again.
Okay.
Let me just try this again. That was so easy, and then. Okay. There we go. Okay, thanks for noticing that.
The next speaker is Dr. Jeff Lundeen from the National Research Council of Canada, and the title of his talk is "Design Photons from Barotrygian Waveguides."
Okay. Hopefully that'll work. Okay, so I am now at the National Research Council in Ottawa at the Institute for National Measurement Standards. But most of this work was done, or all of this work actually was done at Oxford with Professor Ian Walmsley. And the students that worked on it were Peter Mosley, Ophir Cohen. We had a great summer student from ENS, Pierre Mahou, and another postdoc, Brian Smith. So one of the main subjects of this talk is to try is about experiments that are trying to create the textbook photon. So by the textbook photon, I'm really talking about the photon that we learned about in grad school, the photon that's in free space as opposed to in a cavity. And this photon is can be written down in this way, where F is a spectral amplitude, so the amplitude to have a photon at a particular frequency, omega. So you can say, represent your photon as having a Gaussian wave packet where each one of these amplitudes is just the amplitude to have a particular frequency. The key thing about this state is that in almost all of the experiments that you've heard about in this conference, this is not the photon that they're using. Instead, they end up using a photon that has a large degree of mixedness to it. So this is a pure state. If you consider this as the wave function of the photon, which is sort of a rough way of looking at it, the photons that we'd like to have for experiments are pure, whereas the ones that we tend to be making are mixed. So why do we want a photon in a pure frequency or spectral state or pure quantum state? Well, in particular, for the frequency degree of freedom, recently people are learning how to manipulate that degree of freedom and using it for carrying information. So there's an experiment by Rempa where they put phase shifts across their wave packet, and also one by Harris where he uses electro-optic modulators to vary the time profile of his photons. And this shouldn't be discarded as just sort of something interesting. You have to remember that the photon really doesn't have all that many degrees of freedom, and we'd like to transmit it down fibers. So typically we use the polarization degree of freedom, but really, I mean, if we want to carry the most information per photon as possible, we want to use all of its degrees of freedom, and frequency and time are really the only one that's left in a fiber, because position and momentum aren't free anymore. There are two, the general way to make a photon is to have some sort of emitter, and it spontaneously emits a single photon, and usually it does it in all directions because it's stimulated by the vacuum. And there are many vacuum modes going in many different directions, many different frequencies. And there are two strategies to get around that. One is you put your emitter in a cavity. So this is a picture from one of Rempa's papers. And the cavity restricts the vacuum modes that exist, and so the emitter only emits in one direction, and hopefully you collect all those photons. The other way to get around this is to use ensembles and to use pair generation. So most recently, a good example of this is atomic ensembles, where you have a Stokes and anti-Stokes photon, and one heralds the existence of the other. The nice thing about this is that detection of one of these photons puts the atomic cloud into a superposition across the atomic cloud, so all the emitters are put into a certain superposition, and that causes the other photon to be emitted in a correlated direction. So this sort of tames the vacuum by using interference between all the emitters in the cloud. And it's the same sort of thing as what happens here, because here we just have interference between the many reflections through the emitter. So I'm talking about the ensemble type of emitter. In particular, I'm going to be talking about spontaneous four-wave mixing in fibers. So in this system, we have a pump pulse that comes into your fiber, and two photons in that pump pulse can spontaneously scatter off of each other and create an idler and a signal photon. Energy is conserved in this process, and momentum is conserved as well. The nice thing about fibers is that they have a small core size and a long interaction length. So because there's two photons in the pump that are contributing to this process, the efficiency of the process goes with the peak power, as opposed to what you might be more familiar with is spontaneous parametric down conversion. That happens in a Chi2 crystal, which only goes with the overall energy in the pulse. So we can use these to create single photons by using one of the photons of the pair to herald the photon in the other beam. So that's the way we create single photon states. And then we might use those single photon states in quantum circuits, like you've heard a lot about in this conference. This is one from LOQC. And the thing about these quantum circuits is that they all operate by Hongel-Mandel interference, where you have two photons coming in from opposite sides of your beam splitter, and sort of magically they bunch together as if they're sticking together and always leave through one output port. So this sort of pseudo-interaction is leveraged into a real interaction by using measurement. But the key thing that I want you to take away from this is that the quality of these gates, and this is the same sort of thing that we use to put together cluster states for photons, and even in quantum repeaters, the quality of all these gates is dependent on the visibility of this Hongel-Mandel interference. And for this to be good, we need our photons to be in pure quantum states. So we need that textbook photon that I was talking about earlier. So the problem is something stems from something I mentioned earlier, and that is energy and momentum conservation. So we have energy and momentum conservation in all of these ensemble processes, emitters, and that creates correlations between the frequency of the signal photon and the frequency of the idler photon. So here I've written down the quantum state of the two photons, and here instead of just the spectral amplitude, I have the joint spectral amplitude. So that's what I'm plotting here. It's a density plot of that. And to see why that's a problem, you can think about it more easily in the time picture. So you take the Fourier transform, and these anti-correlations from energy conservation turn into time correlations. So if our idler photon is produced early, then our signal photon will also be produced early relative to our pump pulse. So the problem with time correlations is that if we have two of these sources, and we're using them to produce one heralded photon each, then if this detector doesn't have good timing resolution, and in fact no detectors have timing resolution on the order of the wave packets of these photons, these are on the order of femtoseconds, then a detection at this detector, at the heralding detector, will collapse the heralded photon into a random time state. The Hongel-Mandel interference only occurs if the two photons are identical. So if they're collapsed into random time states, they're arriving at the beam splitter at random times relative to each other, and that means they're not identical. So it'll degrade the quality of our Hongel-Mandel interference. So if you vary the length of this path relative to this path, what you usually see in Hongel-Mandel interference is you see the number of coincidences between these detectors go to zero, and when you have these correlations, you see that it gets degraded and you get a reduced visibility. You can quantitatively relate that visibility, and it turns out it's just equal to the purity of both of those photons, assuming they're identical. So this isn't very surprising, because these correlations are really an entanglement between the two photons, and we're ignoring one of our systems. And because we have entanglement between the two systems, when we ignore one, we leave the other one in a mixed state. So one way to look at this entanglement is to do a Schmidt mode decomposition of it. So this is just writing our frequency entangled state as a sum of product states. And one of the reasons why this is a nice thing to do for illustrative purposes is because these aren't just good sources of single photons. Recently, people have started talking about down-conversion sources and pair-generation sources as ways of producing vacuum-squeezed light, in particular, two-mode vacuum-squeezed light, which is a resource for quantum information. It's an entangled state resource. And the thing is that each one of these Schmidt modes that are produced, that you decompose this state into, is actually a separate two-mode squeezed state. So this can be a good thing if you want lots of two-mode squeezed states, but you notice that their structure is fairly complicated. And so it can be hard to detect them in the proper way. And in effect, what you tend to do is just sort of mix between them, which averages out the correlations between them. So what we'd really like is this sort of state. This is what we'd like our source to produce, which is a factorable state. So the way that most experiments deal with this now, so you've heard a lot about successful experiments so far, and the way they deal with it is just by putting in filters. If you put in filters, you filter away these correlations. This is going to hurt your efficiency, and basically your purity, so the purity is the green line here, and your efficiency is the is a blue line, and this is your filter bandwidth in nanometers. You see there's a trade-off, and really the purity only goes asymptotically to one. So you can't really win. You're giving up rates for efficiency, and you go into a sort of post-selected case, and that's not what we'd like to be. We don't want our gates to only operate randomly on post-selection on the logical qubits getting through. So what's the solution? The solution, so this is our goal. We'd like our joint spectral amplitude to be written as a factorable state, and our solution comes from the recognition that you can write this joint spectral amplitude as an energy conservation function times a momentum conservation function. The energy conservation function just stems from this, and it just tells you, you can plot it like this. So this is just saying that if we had the right pump frequency, we would produce an idler photon at that frequency and a sigma photon at that frequency. So this is just this is just proportional to our pump bandwidth. The momentum conservation function we can now play with. This is fixed at 45 degrees, but this has the optical indices in it for each of the photons, and those we can play with through dispersion. So we have another function here, and typically you multiply them and you get something that still has correlations. The angle of this function just has to do with the time difference between when the photons leave your crystal or your fiber. So we can play with that by playing with the dispersion. And in particular, you can identify cases where the idler photon travels at the same speed as the pump photon in your material, and you get this case. So it's clear that if this was rotated all the way to minus 45 degrees, that when you multiply these two functions, you get a nice factorable state. What might not be so clear is that when you multiply this by this, you also get a factorable state. But that's the case that we're going to be aiming for. So by playing with the dispersion, we can really get rid of these correlations and produce a pure quantum state. We've done this in a Chi-2 system in KDP crystal, which is one of the few crystal systems where the dispersion is correct to do this in the visible. And what it allowed us to do is get a very high visibility Hung Mandeldip without using any filters, without throwing away our photons at all. So this has proven to be very successful. It's given us really high heralding efficiencies, much higher than anybody else, and also really high count rates. So it seems to be a successful strategy to use. The question is, how do you apply this? That was for three-wave mixing. The question is, how do you apply this for four-wave mixing? So to do that, you need to model the dispersion in your fiber. So here, our fibers are going to be photonic crystal fibers. These are just, in this case, it's just going to be a solid core of glass surrounded by a sort of lattice of holes. And what you want to do is you want to model the dispersion in that fiber. That's a little, that hadn't been done so far, so particularly for birefringent fibers, so we tackled that. But the nice thing about these fibers is that you can design the dispersion somewhat because they're structured, they're man-made. And there's a lot of parameters that you can design. So there's the air fill fraction, so basically how big those holes are. There's the core diameter, and there's the core birefringence, so the aspect ratio of that. So by varying all those, we can, say, pick a certain set of parameters and derive curves that give us the solution to energy and momentum conservation. So these are those curves for a particular photonic crystal fiber. So this is our pump frequency, and this is our idler and signal splitting from the pump frequency. So for instance, if we pumped at this frequency, we would get an idler out here and we get a signal out there. And these three different curves, the red, green, and blue, are just for different birefringences. The key thing I want you to take away from this is that for the negative birefringence curve, the red one, we have a circle. The slope of this curve is really telling us the angle of that momentum conservation function. So having a circle really means we can go through to any angle we want, and we can pick whatever correlations we want in our photons. So in this talk, I'm talking about getting rid of correlations, but you also might want to increase them if they're an entanglement resource that you'd like to use. So all sort of correlations are possible with these fibers, which is a unique result that's not possible in normal fibers, normal optical fibers. So when I went to Oxford, this was sort of presented to me as a project. We could design these fibers, and then our collaborators at Southampton could build them for us. We would design a very particular fiber that had just the right dispersion to give us these conditions. But what ended up happening is I got to Oxford, and it turned out that Southampton's building had burnt down. So they weren't going to make us any fibers. So we were a little bit in a quandary here about where we were going to get our fibers built. But what we realized was that actually these fibers are very flexible. And in fact, the only commercial supplier of photonic crystal fibers actually had many in their library, and their library is maybe 20 fibers or so, that would satisfy conditions in which we could make a factorable state. So we took a few of these fibers, and we sort of mapped out their dispersion. And this is the sort of typical spectrum you see when you pump these fibers. You see an idler. Our pump is gigantic here, and then you see a signal. And in particular, you see a lot of backgrounds. You'd like to get beyond this Raman background in between, like you're splitting between your idler and your signal to be large. So we went through a bunch of fibers. The problem is that the dispersion of the fibers is not well specified when you buy them, so you have to go through and you have to actually find out where the signal and idler are really produced. You can kind of take a good guess based on their specifications, but then you have to go through and check them. And it turns out that if you look at the idler frequency as a function of the pump frequency, the point at which the idler frequency stops changing is a point where you would get a factorable state. And the factorable state that we predict is sort of roughly this with some approximations. So how do we test whether we've actually got a factorable state? Well, we do that Hongel-Mandel experiment that I talked about in the beginning, except now we have our photonic crystal fiber, and we're going to pump it in both directions. So each direction is going to give us a pair of photons, and one of those photons is going to herald the presence of the other. So in this case, the yellow photons are the heralding photons, and the red photons are the two photons that we're going to interfere to look at their purity. So we get these clicks, and then we have an H and a V photon in this path once we get these two clicks, and then we mix the H and the V photon with a wave plate at a polarizing beam splitter, and we look at coincidences. Now the visibility of the curve, the interference curve or the polarization curve, isn't directly related to the purity, but it's simply related by that formula. So what do we see? Well, in the singles rates, we really expected to see unpolarized light, but we saw these oscillations. So we puzzled over that for a while. Eventually, we determined that that was our air conditioner cycling on and off at a 20-minute cycle. So all of our rates kind of have these oscillations superposed on them. So these are our four photon rates. So this is two heralding detections and two heralded photons being detected in our purity measurement. And we need to normalize out these oscillations. So that's what this is, our four photon rates, and we normalize out these oscillations, and this is what we get. So what this shows us is that our photons are pretty pure. They're 86% pure. We actually predicted they should have 90% purity based on the length of fiber that we had. So they're a little bit less, and we are still not exactly sure why that is, but it probably has something to do with inhomogeneities along the fiber and also just a breakdown of the sort of model that we're using for four-wave mixing. There isn't a very good quantum model for four-wave mixing, spontaneous four-wave mixing in fibers yet. The nice thing about this type of source is now there isn't this trade-off between filter bandwidth and purity, so you don't have to give up photons anymore. Okay, so that was that's sort of where we left things about a year ago. But what we realized is that really these photonic crystal fibers are kind of overrated. They're hard to use, right? It's hard to get light into them. It's hard to get light out of them. And so what we realized is that actually they're sort of overkill. They have a really tiny core, so they give you a high intensity. But we don't really need that because we're only pumping them with half a milliwatt anyway. And we have a Thai SAF, which has 3 watts of light, so you have tons of light to spare. So what we did is we said, okay, well, is this possible at all in normal fibers that you could buy from, say, Thor Labs or something like that? And it turns out it is. If you just get a birefringent fiber from Thor Labs, then you can solve it and find the phase matching conditions tell you that you get a large separation between your idler and your signal, enough to avoid the Raman background. And in fact, you don't have to turn up your intensity that much. You only have to pump with about 10 milliwatts or so. And you don't need a long length of fiber either. You only need about 10 centimeters. And we get about the same rates out of the photonic crystal fiber as this fiber. And in fact, we don't even need the photonic crystal fiber to get those unique factorability dispersion relations. we looked at the spectral state that we were getting out of this fiber, and we found that because it's tilted in this direction, we realized that if we just reduced our pump bandwidth enough, this would go to a circle. We didn't really have the ability at that time to do that with our pump, so we just really verified that the fiber was acting the way we thought. So photonic crystal fibers are overkill, and if you'd like to make a fiber pair source, you can just use a standard Thorlabs fiber. This also made us realize that perhaps the optical circuits that Anthony Lang was talking about earlier in the conference, these are silica on silicon circuits, are compatible also with our way of fiber production or photon pair production. These circuits work particularly well because they're a lot like fiber modes. They're very big. We can make them with a very good quality. So this is different than the sort of silicon waveguide technology that you heard in the last talk or the talk before that. The nice thing about these waveguides is that they're very low loss, which is important for quantum systems. So since they're a lot like fiber modes, you can use exactly the same type of phase matching relations. You just need birefringence in them, and you might be able to produce photons on the same chip in which you process them. The only thing we really need to figure out is how to do the on-chip frequency filtering. We need to get rid of the pump. So that makes the end of my talk. To summarize, we've shown how to generate pure state photons in waveguides. We've shown that microstructured sources allow us to engineer the dispersion to make correlations, anti-correlations in the frequency. And we've shown that I'll just stop there, actually. Thanks.